You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with none other than Deacon Stephen Gradonis. It is our Friday, our first Friday in Lent. It's also just a regular old first Friday as well. And it being first Friday in Lent, we actually got a question today. Somebody wrote me. And was hoping we could discuss this on the show. So I figured this would be a good place to start since we're right in the middle of Lent now. So Joseph writes, I believe he's a Canadian, and he writes and he says, I do have a question about almsgiving. I usually give money to homeless people and people who beg on the street. Sometimes I suspect they're using the alms for alcohol or drugs. Sometimes it is obvious and sometimes it's not. I have bought food and non-alcohol liquids for someone begging, but I still felt compelled to slip them a buck or two. Does the act become immoral if I know or suspect that the recipient of alms uses the money for above stated illicit purposes? I think of that line from Hearts in Atlantis with Anthony Hopkins and Anton Yelchin, quote, "He never bought a drunk a drink."
So it's a very good question. It is a question that has been much debated and controverted. The useful thing would be to know what sociological data there is on this subject, on what happens when you actually give homeless people money on the street. And unfortunately, with such a politically loaded topic, good science is hard to find. I have done some digging on this subject. I've looked into some of the results that are out there, and there are conflicting findings, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. And given the current crisis in sociology with the reproducibility of studies, I'm not going to put a whole lot of stock in that. So I like the solution of Cardinal Dolan in New York. Cardinal Dolan carries gift certificates for Starbucks or whatever with him wherever he goes. And when he encounters a panhandler, he gives him the gift certificate. So it's halfway in between giving them actual money and walking them into a store and buying them food, which is time consuming. Mm-hmm. You also, something that I found in my experience is that when you try to step up your level of involvement with a panhandler, if they are a person who is trying to scam you, they have amazing defenses to deter you from getting to the bottom of their story. You know, a woman is begging outside of a Dunkin' Donuts, and her car has run out of gas, and she just needs it. Okay, you offer to buy her gas. You're gonna drive her to the gas station and buy her a tank full of gas. Suddenly, her cell phone rings, and somebody's coming to help her out, and the problem is solved. Uh-huh. So, you know, and I've seen this happen also with people begging to buy food or whatever else. So I like the gift certificate solution. I'm certainly not. It's not a sin, obviously, to give somebody who's begging for money if you don't know how they're going to spend it.
Right.
It may not be the most prudent or helpful possible choice that you could make, but it's a good and pious thing to do, and it's been done for centuries by saints, and I certainly wouldn't worry or scruple about that. Yeah. But if you want to be sure that you're helping people and doing what you can to prevent them from spending the money illicitly, then you might want to consider something like that.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes, of course, there's a distinction between feeding somebody's addiction and assuming that somebody has an
right.
addiction, when a lot of times, you know, people are down and out for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with addiction. There's a famous story. I always thought it was a Tolkien and Lewis story. It turns out that it was a Lewis and Walter Hooper story.
Ah.
They actually went out and did the footwork on this. But there's a famous story about Lewis. Lewis liked to take walking trips. And he was out taking a walk one day with his secretary, Walter Hooper. And some guy asked him for money. And Lewis was famously generous with whatever money he had. And so he reached into his pocket and gave the guy whatever it was he had. And they walked on. And Hooper said, well, you know, he's just going to spend that on drink. And Lewis's response was, I was just going to spend it on drink. And his point, which I think is well taken, is we very often have this notion that the poor have no right to their pleasures. If they're taking any kind of pleasure out of life, then that somehow they're cheating us. And Lewis's attitude, I think, there was a real measure of wisdom there, that let the poor have their pleasures sometimes. I mean, God knows they have little enough, you know. So what if the guy goes and buys a pack of smokes? I mean, it's, you know, he's living a miserable life, and you haven't been really cheated out of anything. And so there's something to that as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we need to recognize that we are this person's economic superior in the situation. That doesn't make us their moral superior. It doesn't make us their judge.
Right.
And if we have extra and they have a lack, then they have a certain claim on what we have and how they use what we give them in justice is, I mean, we want to try to help them if we can, but at the end of the day, we're not the boss of them.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that there is that to take into account as well. Now, you know, there are times, I think those times are far rarer than we tend to assume they are, where somebody is scamming you. If somebody's living on the street, you know what? They're really not doing a good job of cheating other people. They're living on the street and you're not. And that's the first thing to always bear in mind is, you know, if they go and blow it on something, well, you know, I'm not going to cry too much if some guy who's literally living in a tent goes and buys a candy bar instead of investing it wisely somewhere, you know, because that's, you know, that's his, he's entitled to a little bit of happiness too. So anyway, thank you, Joseph, for that. That was a good question. I thought that was an interesting one. And by the way, if you're out there in Radio Land listening in, you want to join us, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You know, before we get any further into this, I think it's really important to have a conversation with Deacon Stephen Gardanus on a subject that is really near and dear to his heart, which is the need to observe super light penances during Lent. He doesn't want anybody to, you know, have any troubles or anything. And at least that's how I remember you saying it. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing what you think. I mean, you're going to go like wolf down some giant sushi dinner when we're done here, right? Is that what's happening? Or
are you snorting?
I am. I'm just snorting just a little bit. I have a cold. So
I have a cold too. How about that?
There it is. Yes.
United in suffering.
Okay.
Appropriately so, because it's Lent.
Because it's Lent. So tell us your views on fasting during Lent. I know people want to hear this. So,
okay. So, okay. A little bit of history. Once upon a time, if you don't have to go back all that far in history, Catholics were expected to abstain from meat for the entirety of Lent, from Ash Wednesday until Easter. Mm-hmm. Along with meat, there were also eggs, which is where we get the Easter egg tradition, because Easter is when eggs come back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people who are eating eggs throughout Easter, when the Easter eggs come, it's not that special the way that it's supposed to be. And in the Eastern churches, you know, where they already were abstaining from meat on all Fridays of the year, all 52, and all 52 Wednesdays as well, Wednesdays and Fridays, both days of abstinence in the Eastern churches. In Lent, they just go nuts. Uh-huh. All of the, you know, not only meat and dairy and eggs, and I think oil and wine, except maybe on the weekends. The list goes on. Right. And when Western Catholics hear this, this is really scary for them. And mm-hmm. so I have a very modest suggestion. The modest suggestion is not, you know, try to run to the ends of the earth and take on the hardest penance you can, but think of a penance that scares you for this Lent and try that. And then next year, add something else and try to ramp up slowly, baby steps. But when we come back from the break, we'll talk some more about what fasting and abstinence, why they're important, and why we should be doing more than what is currently required of us by Catholic law.
All right, we will do that. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about fasting and Lent, and then we'll be moving on to movies and lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. We'll be back right after this on Connecting the Dots.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We are talking about Lent, and I decided, this being the first Friday in Lent, and knowing that Steve has strong views on the, well, what's a good word for it? Pathetic, lame, sad sack, sorry, our Lenten discipline, such as it is, is just pretty weak when it comes to fasting and so forth. So,
and we need to put that in some context, because while many of our listeners may already be familiar with this idea and may agree with us, people who are being exposed to this for the first time might wonder why we're saying this and why we're trashing the current discipline of the church. And, you know, I think I'm a man who embraces hyperbole and strong language, and I'm a man of strong opinions. And I don't mind saying, yeah, I'm trashing the current discipline of the church. I'm okay with that. Okay. I'll be hearing from my cardinal on Monday morning, I'm sure.
Okay. But
yes, here I am, Deacon Stephen, and I am saying that the church asks far, far too little of us. And I wouldn't mind if there were a very low bar that was the minimum that was expected for everyone, except for cases of medical necessity. But then, since you have the possibility of making exceptions for cases of medical necessity, why not set the bar a little higher? Mm-hmm. So this is where we are. Jesus, in the reading from the Sermon on the Mount, one of the readings that we did not do, I think, in this past cycle, tells us, when you fast, Do not be like the hypocrites. Oh no, but we did this. We did this on Ash Wednesday. That's when we
did. Right. Yeah.
Do not be like the hypocrites who disfigure their appearances so that they may appear to be fasting. But when you fast, wash your face and anoint your head so that you will not. Here's the important words. When you fast, Jesus assumes that his disciples will fast.
Mm-hmm.
He's when the Pharisees come to Jesus and say to him, why do your disciples not fast like, you know, our disciples do? And Jesus' response is, can the wedding guests fast when the bridegroom is among them? But the day will come when the bridegroom is taken away and then they will fast. Now, I don't think he meant 2 days out of the year, which is what the current Catholic discipline is. Literally, right. There is nothing to stop you from eating like 20 hours a day if you want, 363 days a year. And on leap year, 364 days a year. The only day that the church asks you to do anything that could be called fasting is on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. That's it. That's it. And on those days, you're still allowed to eat three times a day. You can have one meal, and then on two other occasions, you can have some food. You may hear this pious formula at your parish. You know, somebody may stand up and make an announcement and say, two snacks that together don't equal a whole meal. And that's not in the canon. That's not what the law says. The law just says some food. And by implication, it's some food that's less than a meal. But how much less is really left up to your discretion. So
right.
There are some people who cannot fast at all. You know, people who are prone to migraines and who have other physical issues. And fasting just isn't going to work for them. And they can have their medical exceptions. But we should be fasting more than 2 days a year. And our fasting, for most of us who are generally healthy adults, it should look a little more rigorous than eating three times a day. That's
yeah. I remember one time because I, you know, when I was a fairly new Catholic, one of the things that I just didn't get, for some reason, I just don't have a brain that retains this kind of stuff. I still am like not super clear on. I just don't eat stuff like until dinner time on a fast day.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I do it because I can't remember like all the sort of nitinoid exceptions and requirements and stuff like this. And one of the things that was always I couldn't ever get clear was, are you supposed to fast for an hour before Mass or for an hour before Eucharist? And and I was like, I'm not even clear on that. I remember coming in one time because it was Sunday morning Mass and I'd forgotten. And I grabbed a bite to eat, you know, because we were in a hurry and I was running around and doing stuff. And so I grabbed something to eat. And then I thought, oh, it's Sunday and I'm going to. And then I thought, what's the requirement? I don't even know. So I came in and I stood next to this friend of mine. I said, what's the deal? Are you not supposed to eat an hour before Mass begins or an hour before receiving the Eucharist? And he goes, it's an hour before receiving the Eucharist, and it's just a venial sin, and receiving the Eucharist forgives venial sin. And I just thought, tell me a Jesuit didn't invent all of this, you know? I mean, what is this? This is silly, you know? But
that response is really the problem with the lax state of the law, is that it's not really any kind of self-discipline. It's tokenism. You could even call it legalism because you can write it down on a piece of paper that it's fasting, but that's you're satisfying a requirement on a piece of paper. And tokenistic legalism breeds contempt for law. That's the it's like it's a little bit like the story that Viktor Frankl tells about how the Nazis would break people's spirits by having them shovel a pile of dirt from point A to point B. And then when they were done, they had to shuffle it back from point B to point A, because people can take torture better than they can take something that just seems absurd and meaningless.
Right. Right. Yeah. And this is why I've always, I think that's part of the reason that I'm not good at this kind of legislation and legalism, because it doesn't feel like, and I don't believe it is, anything to do with actual relationship with God. And I can see how the church as an institution, you know, gets questions from people. What am I supposed to do? And so, you know, here's somebody in the church who's faced with a simple soul who just wants to know what he's supposed to do. Okay, so you do this thing. But the thing is that when you start codifying everything, that's the moment that for a lot of times the whole purpose and meaning of it in with respect to relationship just kind of drains away. And I'm much easier with just saying, look, we fast because Jesus fasted, and we're trying to identify that, you know, that little bit of hardship and suffering that you go through when you're hungry with Jesus in the desert. That makes sense to me. That makes a lot more sense to me than, you know, two partial meals not equaling a total meal, you know. And that kind of odd codification just doesn't do anything for me. And I can see how people, you know, immediately what people start looking for is, like, how do I get around this? And, you know, how can I jailhouse lawyer my way through this? And it's just, it seems to me to be absolutely foreign to the spirit of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, so what do you, to pursue a serious fast in the spirit of the Catholic tradition, what do you recommend?
Well, I recommend, as I was starting to say before the break, I recommend an incremental approach. I recommend doing something, and I like C.S. Lewis's response to the question, how much money should we give to charity? His response is, if we're not giving enough that it, I don't remember his exact wording, but the basic sense was, if we're not giving enough so that it hurts a little bit, that it inconveniences us, that we have to do without something that we would like to have, then we're not giving enough. So I think that our penance ought to be something that we're a little uncomfortable with. I think we ought to challenge ourselves. And what that means for different people, there's a wide spectrum. I know Catholics who every Friday in Lent, and before Friday comes, and before Lent comes, they're already loudly complaining about the agony of going 24 hours or 36 hours or whatever it is from that last bite of hamburger on Thursday to that first bite of sausage on Saturday morning. Just the unbelievable suffering of going one day without warm-blooded meat is just more than they can handle.
Yeah.
So if you're that guy or that girl, my recommendation to you might just be, why don't you try doing it without complaining? That might be enough of a first step for you.
Well, okay.
And, you know, for...
That makes sense.
For a lot of other people, for people who are already kind of taking that in stride, you know, you order your pizza and you just get it with peppers instead of with pepperoni. And, you know, you're okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't you add Wednesday too? Just Wednesday as a second day of abstinence. The church doesn't require it of you, but it's what Catholics for many, many generations have done, particularly in the East, you know, since ancient times. And it would be a good thing.
Well, we could, and, you know, when we get back, we could talk about the concept of the beer fast. This is a great... We'll be back with Deacon Stephen Gardonis here on Connecting the Dots right after this. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and you are listening to Breadbox Media. Back in a minute. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to the Dots. I'm here, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We've been talking about fasting, and I basically let Steve Gradonis play bad cop so that I could be, you know, like good cop and say, you don't have to listen to what mean Deacon Steve says. Even his cardinal is probably going to call him on Monday. I think there is something to it. Now, how I'm going to do this, I don't really know. I've been trying to think actually for the last couple of days about what I should be giving up, and I haven't really come to any solid conclusions yet. Partly because I've been running around and partly because I've been sick and it's been hard for me to focus. My provisional sacrifice has been things like breathing. Lots of coughing and that sort of thing. I still want to do something in this department, but I haven't figured out what yet. So I used to give up things like chocolate, which was a real sacrifice for me. But lately that I just haven't eaten a lot of chocolate. I lost about 80 pounds, and part of it was just, through the grace of the sacrament of anointing, which I experienced as just a miraculous intervention of grace in my life. I lost 80 pounds after struggling for years and years and years with my appetites. I got anointed by a priest, and bam, these appetites that had just controlled me died. And that happened during Lent a few years back. So I'm one of these people who's like, you know, you have any kind of medical issues that are bothering you, go to the sacrament of anointing. Don't waste time. You know, make use of that grace, because it's real and it's powerful. Wanted to kind of give you the last word here. Any final words on what do you think about the idea of the beer fast? 17th century monks would actually just go without all food except for beer for 40 days, which for me would be an agonizing penance because I hate beer.
Yeah, I'm not a fan either. Now, I have an alcohol-based fast as well. It goes in the more traditional direction of, you know, not drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. For me, it's wine. I drink wine all the time when it's not Lent, but during Lent, I don't drink any wine at all. So that's one thing. Yeah. Other things that people might want to consider giving up to the extent that they can. And, you know, with that principle of incrementalism, you know, if you can, you know, try to wean yourself down from eating meat, you know, can you go at least Wednesday and Friday? Can you maybe go Monday, Wednesday and Friday? Can, you know, maybe next year go all the weekdays, or at least take minimal amounts of meat, you know, reduce if you can't eliminate completely. Work on, you know, I think giving up eggs is a great thing to do because mm-hmm. of the whole Easter egg tradition. Mm-hmm. The Eastern Orthodox are expected, married couples are expected to give up sex for the 40 days of Lent. Mm. So for those of us who are married, that might be something to aspire to. Mm-hmm. Those of us who are not married should aspire to not having sex at all.
okay.
Nothing to do with Lent.
Uh-huh.
But challenge yourself. But then also, of course, we have to remember that fasting needs to be linked to the other two pillars of Lenten discipline, which are prayer and almsgiving. Fasting all by itself, you know, yes, it's good to have self-discipline. It's good to have self-mastery. But if it's going to be done to honor Christ and not just to, you know, strengthen yourself as an individual, then it needs to be united to prayer and it needs to be united to almsgiving.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that that covers it. I want to move on to the movies now.
Yes.
You've seen a couple. Talk about them.
So, The Shack opens this weekend. And for listeners who may not be familiar with it, The Shack was a huge cultural bellwether about 7 or 10 years ago. It debuted as a novel in 2007, the first time author William Young, who self-published his novel he originally wrote for his children, wound up self-publishing after it was turned down by a real publisher, and it became a bestseller. Mm. And it sold, I don't know how many copies, but, you know, a whole lot of copies. Mm-hmm. And it has been hailed and acclaimed by many as a Christian masterpiece, a masterpiece of Christian spirituality. The well-known Protestant writer Eugene Peterson compared it to Pilgrim's Progress in a blurb that's on the front cover of the book.
Okay.
Other people have gone after The Shack for its alleged heresies. Okay. It's been accused of universalism, of patripassianism, which, for those listeners who may not be familiar with it, is
the heresy. I know what that is.
Yes. Why don't you tell us, Mark?
Theological nerdery. Patripassianism. The church teaches that God, in his divine nature, is impassible. That doesn't mean you can't get in front of him on the freeway. What it means is that God, in his nature, can't suffer because he is perfect in happiness. It is in his human nature that Jesus suffers on the cross, but God the Father does not experience suffering. And that, when we hear that, what that always translates to us is, you know, God is cold and unfeeling and doesn't really love us, and et cetera, et cetera. That's not what the church is talking about there. God is love.
Yes.
But in his divine nature, because God is perfect happiness, perfectly happy, and his creatures can't hurt him. So that's basically the
and connected with that, of course,
God the Father. So when we say patripassianism, we're talking about God the Father,
right? So Jesus, in his humanity, Jesus becomes incarnate and is able to suffer in his humanity. And because of a theological principle having to do with the idiomatic relationship of Jesus' divine and human natures, we can say, for instance, that we worship a man, or we can say that God died for us. But when we say that God died for us, we mean God the Son. We don't mean God the Father. God the Father is not incarnate in Jesus Christ. God the Father was not crucified. And so the patripassianism is a particular version of modalism, the idea that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are all basically the same, really. It's just one God with different masks or different identities. So that we can say that the Father suffered on the cross. And in the movie The Shack, there's a scene in which the character who represents God the Father, who some people might find this odd, is played by Octavia Spencer, rolls up her sleeves and shows that she has scars on her wrists, just like the actor who plays Jesus. He has scars also. And the idea is that the Father suffers when his Son is crucified. And so people say, patripassianism. And, you know, it does look like patripassianism, because you do have God the Father seemingly suffering the wounds of having been crucified. But having said all that, the movie knows perfectly well that God the Father is not, in fact, a black woman. The movie knows perfectly well that God the Father does not have a body and does not have wrists. So the scars are a metaphor. What are they a metaphor for? Well, you can interpret that metaphor in different ways. One way might be to say that Jesus is the only icon of the Father, the image of the Father that we have. He who has seen Jesus has seen the Father. And so Jesus, loves us, and he shows that love for us on the cross. So the wounds that he bears are the marks of his love. And in the marks of his love, we see the love of the Father. So that's one way to look at those scars. So, you know, it's a book, and you don't have to. It contains metaphors, and not everything that you can apply a heretical interpretation to is that necessarily the only way to take it.
Okay. All right. As drama, as film, how would you rate this?
Well, it's not very good.
Okay.
This is the thing. People have had transformative spiritual experiences reading The Shack. Mm-hmm. There are also people who love the paintings of Thomas Kincaid.
Yes.
And there are people for whom repetitive praise choruses with rather banal lyrics, I would think, it's just the most spiritually uplifting thing in the world. And, you know, I'm using kind of demeaning language here, and I don't want to demean anyone's experience of God. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody looks at a Thomas Kincaid painting and they have a spiritual experience, and that is real. And they encounter God in that Thomas Kincaid painting. And people encounter God reading The Shack, and people encounter God listening to praise music. And yet, nevertheless, I think we have to make some very important critiques of all of these things.
Okay. All right. Well, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. When we get back, we will be talking about a superhero movie for Lent. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Deacon Stephen Gradonis, who, among other things, is the owner and operator of DecentFilms.com. Noted film critic, close personal friend of Martin Scorsese. And, I mean, they're like that, really. It's just amazing. He knows him so well. And anyway, we've been talking about The Shack, and you had a bit more you wanted to say about The Shack.
Yeah, well, so just to get it out of the way, my review of The Shack is up at the National Catholic Register website. I have not yet posted it at Decent Films. I've been busy. But, you know, The Shack is basically an exploration of theodicy, the problem of evil. And it deals with this main character who has suffered great tragedy and loss in his life. Mm-hmm. And it, in that connection, it has a very reassuring message. It tells us that in spite of all that is evil in the world, that there is a God who is good and who loves us very much and who is all powerful. And the exact relationship of this God to God is not the author of evil, does not cause evil to come into being. Everything that God causes is only good, but evil and suffering are connected with human freedom. They're ultimately a mystery that we can't completely understand, but God is always with us in our sufferings. God suffers with us. God loves us and is always working through evil for our good. And all of these are, you know, that's pretty much what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So there are problems with The Shack. I don't think that they're at the absolute center of the story, but there are problems both with the book and with the film. You know, the book kind of suggests that God, that the church is more a human thing than a divine thing. Jesus says something about not founding institutions, and even In the movie, God has a line about how Jesus says, you know, as long as people are able to be transformed by Papa's love, then, you know, it doesn't matter what religion you are, what label you call yourself. So, you know, these are significant issues. These are errors. These are problems.
Right. But that's kind of standard in many ways. That's kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it, standard sort of post-Norman Vincent Peale Protestant ecclesiology. I mean, yeah.
So, but I think it's important to recognize that at the kernel of the film is something good, that it isn't like there's a little bit of truth on the surface, but at the core is something rotten. It's really the other way around. But the movie does have very significant problems. One of the things I think is very important to recognize is that the movie presents the protagonist's needs as fundamentally he needs healing rather than salvation. It's not a soteriological vision. It's a therapeutic vision. So he's a broken man who needs healing. He needs to learn to forgive and to be there for those that love him. But he's not a sinner who's in need of redemption and salvation, who needs to realize that he's done wrong and who needs God's grace in his life. And that, I think, more than anything else, is what concerns me, is this very, very therapeutic focus on this man's broken relationship with God.
Okay. Yeah. Who was it? Rod Dreher is referred to it as moralistic therapeutic deism.
Exactly. In this case, it is Trinitarian. It is Christian, mm-hmm. but it's moralistic therapeutic Christian theology influenced deism.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I probably take a pass on that one, but
I can't recommend it. But at the same time, I don't want to scream at people who enjoy it. What I said in my review is, you know, God meets people even in treacle and in the maudlin and so forth, and we don't want to. You know, he also meets people in suffering and tragedy, and it doesn't justify those who are guilty of either of those things.
Right.
So,
okay. And so next, talk to me about Logan.
Logan! It's Hugh Jackman. He's Wolverine. He's really big. He's been playing this role for 17 years. Can you believe it? The man is 48 years old. It's crazy.
It's like he's indestructible. You just can't even kill him, you know.
And in my review, I talk about how superheroes, you know, functionally they're all immortal. Some of them have actual immortality as a superpower. Logan is one of them. The character was born in the 19th century, and he has this mutant healing power that he just doesn't age. And Hugh Jackman is one of those people who has defied aging about as well as it can be done. But in this movie, they finally take Wolverine into the future where his powers have begun to fail him. And so age has caught up with him. He's not healing nearly as well as he used to. Patrick Stewart is on hand to play an elderly Professor X. All the other mutants, all the other X-Men, everybody's gone. This is a very bleak dystopian future vision. And Wolverine basically is just exhausted and drinking, and he basically wants oblivion. Mm-hmm. And Patrick Stewart as Professor X, he's brittle, he's confused, he has dementia, and so he too is not long for this world. But there is someone who is. There's a young girl named Laura who shows up in the story. Professor X says that she's a mutant because she does have powers. Her origin turns out to be a little bit different from the mutants that we're familiar with. And she turns out to have – she's a, like this very feral character. She doesn't seem to speak. And she has powers that put her – let's just say they put her in a class with Wolverine.
Okay.
So – what makes this story different from all other Wolverine stories, besides the very the grim setting and the sense that this is a Twilight story for Wolverine, is that it is also a post-Deadpool story. And James Mangold, who directed The Wolverine, also directed this film. He directed 310 to Yuma, which was a Western that a lot of people loved and that I hated.
Okay.
This movie, like, this is rated R, and mm-hmm. this is the Wolverine, like the no holds barred Wolverine movie, R-rated outing that fans of his most gruesome experiences in the comic book have been looking forward to for a long time.
Mm.
So, you know, he's always had those knives that pop out of his knuckles, but now he really uses them to full gory effect, and skulls are cloven and limbs are lopped off. And it's just, it requires a strong stomach just to get through the opening scene. And there is an ironclad law of action movies, if you don't know it, that whatever level the action is when it starts,
it has to go up from there.
It has to go up from there. So I would say that Wolverine starts at 10.
Mm.
So, you know, in the words of Spinal Tap, it's going up to 11.
To 11. Yeah. Okay.
11.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's too bad.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And, you know, the level of violence on the one hand, it makes sense for a character with Wolverine's powers and with Wolverine's past. But the movie does things that make the violence much less, even more unpalatable than it otherwise would be. Throwing a young girl into it, not only as someone who's a target of violence, but who wreaks deadly violence on other people. I mean, 11-year-old girls chopping people's heads off, that's taking things up to another level. And then, as if that's not enough, the movie introduces innocent supporting characters who embody goodness and domesticity and even piety and religion for no other reason than to give us a diversion and a respite from all of the horror and the bloodshed that we've been surrounded with. And I'm thinking, if the movie kills these characters off, I'm not going to be mad at the bad guys. I'm going to be mad at the filmmakers.
Yeah.
Well, no spoilers, but I'm mad at the filmmakers.
Okay. Yeah. This sounds like the Zack Snyderfication of Marvel. I mean, I have a burning grudge against Zack Snyder, and I hate it when you take, you know, stories like this and then turn them just unbelievably dark like that. It just wrecks it, you know. Okay. Well, thanks for the warning.
What makes it more disappointing to me is that the X-Men movies, not the Wolverine solo movies, but the X-Men movies have been this kind of bastion of hope and idealism in comic book movies, because Bryan Singer, who directed 4 of the 6 films, really imbues them with this spirit of humanistic optimism that mutants and humans can peacefully coexist. And he puts the focus in his movies is really on people who make those moments of moral choice to do the right thing and to hope for a better future. And yeah, to see him kind of despairing and at the end of his life and not having all of his dreams have failed, everything ends badly. That's not the story that we need right now, is my
opinion. Yeah, it's really not. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, I don't know. It's like there's something in the water or something. I don't get it. I want some stories with some hope in them, you know? And it's just, that's too bad. Well, hopefully next week we'll have happier news to report. But anyway, I want to thank you for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We have been here today with Deacon Stephen Gridonis. Our producer was Danny Head, and you've been listening to Redbox Media. And I will see you all on Monday with Sherry Antonetti. Until then, have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.